August 12th. I see the president almost every day, as I happen to live where he passes to or from his lodgings out of town. He never sleeps at the White House during the hot season, but has quarters at a healthy location some 3 miles north of the city, the Soldier's Home, a United States military establishment. I saw him this morning about 8:30, coming into business, riding on Vermont Avenue near L Street. He always has a company of 25 or 30 cavalry, with sabers drawn and held upright over their shoulders. They say this guard was against his personal wish, but he let his counselors have their way. The party makes no great show in uniform or horses. Mr. Lincoln on the saddle generally rides a good-sized, easy-going gray horse, is dressed in plain black, somewhat rusty and dusty, wears a black stiff hat, and looks about as ordinary in attire and so forth as the commonest man. A lieutenant with yellow straps rides at his left, and following behind, two by two, come the cavalrymen in their yellow-striped jackets. They are generally going at a slow trot, as that is the pace set them by the one they wait upon. The sabers and accoutrements clank, and the entirely unornamental cortege, as it trots toward Lafayette Square, arouses no sensation. Only some curious stranger stops and gazes. I see very plainly Abraham Lincoln's dark brown face with the deep-cut lines, the eyes, always to me with the deep, latent sadness in the expression. We have got so that we exchange bows, and very cordial ones. Sometimes the president goes and comes in an open barouche. The cavalry always accompany him with drawn sabers. Often I notice as he goes out evenings, and sometimes in the morning when he returns early, he turns off and halts at the large and handsome residence of the Secretary of War on K Street, and holds conference there. If in his barouche, I can see from my window he does not alight, but sits in his vehicle, and Mr. Stanton comes out to attend him. Sometimes one of his sons, a boy of 10 or 12, accompanies him, riding at his right on a pony. Earlier in the summer, I occasionally saw the president and his wife, toward the latter part of the afternoon, out in a barouche, on a pleasure ride through the city. Mrs. Lincoln was dressed in complete black, with a long crepe veil. The equipage is of the plainest kind, only 2 horses, and nothing extra. They passed me once, very close, and I saw the president in the face fully, as they were moving slowly, and his look, though abstracted, happened to be directed steadily in my eye. He bowed and smiled, but far beneath his smile I noticed well the expression I have alluded to. None of the artists or pictures has caught the deep, though subtle and indirect expression of this man's face. There is something else there. One of the great portrait painters of 2 or 3 centuries ago is needed. October 20th. Tonight, after leaving the hospital at 10 o'clock, I had been on self-imposed duty some 5 hours, pretty closely confined. I wandered a long time around Washington. The night was sweet, very clear, sufficiently cool, a voluptuous half-moon, slightly golden, the space near it of a transparent blue-gray tinge. I walked up Pennsylvania Avenue and then to 7th Street, and a long while around the patent office. Somehow, it looked rebukefully strong, majestic, there in the delicate moonlight. The sky, the planets, the constellations, all so bright, so calm, so expressively silent, so soothing after those hospital scenes. I wandered to and fro till the moist moon set long after midnight. I'm back again in Washington, on my regular daily and nightly rounds. Of course, there are many specialties. Dotting a ward here and there are always cases of poor fellows long suffering under obstinate wounds or weak and disheartened from typhoid fever or the like. Marked cases needing special and sympathetic nourishment. These I sit down and either talk to or silently cheer them up. They always like it hugely, and so do I. Each case has its peculiarities and needs some new adaptation. I have learnt to thus conform, learnt a good deal of hospital wisdom. Some of the poor young chaps, away from home for the first time in their lives, hunger and thirst for affection. This is sometimes the only thing that will reach their condition. The men like to have a pencil and something to write in. I have given them cheap pocket diaries and almanacs for 1864, interleaved with blank paper. For reading, I generally have some old pictorial magazines or story papers. They are always acceptable. Also the morning or evening papers of the day. The best books I do not give, but lend to read through the wards, and then take them to others, and so on. They are very punctual about returning the books. In these wards or on the field, as I thus continue to go round, I have come to adapt myself to each emergency after its kind or call, however trivial, however solemn, everyone justified and made real under its circumstances. Not only visits and cheering talk and little gifts, not only washing and dressing wounds. I have some cases where the patient is unwilling anyone should do this but me. But passages from the Bible, expounding them, prayer at the bedside, explanations of doctrine, and so forth. I think I see my friend smiling at this confession, but I was never more in earnest in my life. In camp and everywhere, I was in the habit of reading or giving recitations to the men. They were very fond of it and liked declamatory poetical pieces. We would gather in a large group by ourselves after supper and spend the time in such readings or in talking, and occasionally by an amusing game called the Game of 20 Questions. A march in the ranks hard pressed and the road unknown. A march in the ranks hard pressed and the road unknown. A route through a heavy wood with muffled steps in the darkness. Our army foiled, with loss severe, and the sullen remnant retreating, till after midnight glimmer upon us the lights of a dim-lighted building. We come to an open space in the woods and halt by the dim-lighted building. 'Tis a large old church at the crossing roads, now an impromptu hospital. Entering but for a minute, I see a sight beyond all the pictures and poems ever made. Shadows of deepest, deepest black, just lit by moving candles and lamps, and by one great pitchy torch, stationary, with wild red flame and clouds of smoke. By these, crowds, groups of forms, vaguely I see on the floor, some in the pews laid down. At my feet, more distinctly, a soldier, a mere lad, in danger of bleeding to death. He is shot in the abdomen. I stanch the blood temporarily. The youngster's face is white as a lily. Then, before I depart, I sweep my eyes o'er the scene, fain to absorb it all. Faces, varieties, postures beyond description, most in obscurity, some of them dead. Surgeons operating, attendants holding lights, the smell of ether, the odor of blood, the crowd, oh, the crowd of the bloody forms, the yard outside also filled, some on the bare ground, some on planks or stretchers, some in the death spasm sweating, an occasional scream or cry, the doctor's shouted orders or calls, the glisten of the little steel instruments catching the glint of the torches. These I resume as I chant. I see again the forms. I smell the odor. Then, here outside, the orders given, "Fall in, my men, fall in!" But first, I bend to the dying lad. His eyes open. A half-smile gives he me. Then the eyes close, calmly close, and I speed forth to the darkness, resuming, marching, ever in darkness marching, on in the ranks, the unknown road still marching. It is Sunday afternoon, middle of summer, hot and oppressive, and very silent through the ward. I am taking care of a critical case, now lying in a half lethargy. Near where I sit is a suffering rebel from the 8th Louisiana. His name is Irving. He has been here a long time, badly wounded, and lately had his leg amputated. It is not doing very well. Right opposite me is a sick soldier boy, laid down with his clothes on, sleeping, looking much wasted, his pallid face on his arm. I see by the yellow trimming on his jacket that he is a cavalry boy. I step softly over and find by his card that he is named William Cone of the 1st Maine Cavalry, and his folks live in Skowhegan. One hot day toward the middle of June, I gave the inmates of Carver Hospital a general ice cream treat, purchasing a large quantity and, under convoy of the doctor or head nurse, going around personally through the wards to see to its distribution. In one of the fights before Atlanta, a rebel soldier of large size, evidently a young man, was mortally wounded top of the head, so that the brains partially exuded. He lived 3 days, lying on his back on the spot where he first dropped. He dug with his heel in the ground during that time, a hole big enough to put in a couple of ordinary knapsacks. He just lay there in the open air, and with little intermission kept his heel going night and day. Some of our soldiers then moved him to a house, but he died in a few minutes. After the battles at Columbia, Tennessee, where we repulsed about a score of vehement rebel charges, they left a great many wounded on the ground, mostly within our range. Whenever any of these wounded attempted to move away by any means, generally by crawling off, our men, without exception, brought them down by a bullet. They let none crawl away, no matter what his condition. March 4th, the inauguration. The president very quietly rode down to the Capitol in his own carriage by himself on a sharp trot about noon, either because he wished to be on hand to sign bills or to get rid of marching in line with the absurd procession, the muslin temple of liberty and pasteboard monitor. I saw him on his return at 3 o'clock after the performance was over. He was in his plain two-horse barouche and looked very much worn and tired. The lines, indeed, of vast responsibilities, intricate questions and demands of life and death, cut deeper than ever upon his dark brown face. Yet all the old goodness, tenderness, sadness, and canny shrewdness underneath the furrows. I never see that man without feeling that he is one to become personally attached to, for his combination of purest, heartiest tenderness and native Western form of manliness. By his side sat his little boy of 10 years. There were no soldiers, only a lot of civilians on horseback, with huge yellow scarfs over their shoulders, riding around the carriage. At the inauguration 4 years ago, he rode down and back again, surrounded by a dense mass of armed cavalrymen 8 deep with drawn sabers, and there were sharpshooters stationed at every corner on the route. I ought to make mention of the closing levee of Saturday night last. Never before was such a compact jam in front of the White House. All the grounds filled, and away out to the spacious sidewalks. I was there, as I took a notion to go, was in the rush inside with the crowd, surged along the passageways, the blue and other rooms, and through the great East Room. Crowds of country people, some very funny. Fine music from the Marine Band off in a side place. I saw Mr. Lincoln, dressed all in black, with white kid gloves and a clawhammer coat, receiving, as in duty bound, shaking hands, looking very disconsolate, and as if he would give anything to be somewhere else. March 27, 1865. Sergeant Calvin F. Harlow, Company C, 29th, Massachusetts, 3rd Brigade, 1st Division, 9th Corps. A marked sample of heroism and death. Some may say bravado, but I say heroism of grandest, oldest order. In the late attack by the rebel troops and temporary capture by them of Fort Stedman at night. The fort was surprised at dead of night. Suddenly awakened from their sleep and rushing from their tents, Harlow, with others, found himself in the hands of the Secesh. They demanded his surrender. He answered, "Never while I live." Of course it was useless. The others surrendered. The odds were too great. Again he was asked to yield, this time by a rebel captain. Though surrounded and quite calm, he again refused, called sternly to his comrades to fight on, and himself attempted to do so. The rebel captain then shot him, but at the same instant he shot the captain. Both fell together mortally wounded. Harlow died almost instantly. The rebels were driven out in a very short time. The body was buried next day, but soon taken up and sent home, Plymouth County, Massachusetts. Harlow was only 22 years of age, was a tall, slim, dark-haired, blue-eyed young man, had come out originally with the 29th, and that is the way he met his death after 4 years' campaign. He was in the 7 days' fight before Richmond, in 2nd Bull Run, Antietam, 1st Fredericksburg, Vicksburg, Jackson, Wilderness, and the campaigns following, was as good a soldier as ever wore the blue, and every old officer in the regiment will bear that testimony. Though so young and in a common rank, he had a spirit as resolute and brave as any hero in the books, ancient or modern. It was too great to say the words, "I surrender," and so he died. When I think of such things, knowing them well, all the vast and complicated events of the war, on which history dwells and makes its volumes, fall aside, and for the moment, at any rate, I see nothing but young Calvin Harlow's figure in the night, disdaining to surrender. The war is over, but the hospitals are fuller than ever from former and current cases. A large majority of the wounds are in the arms and legs, but there is every kind of wound in every part of the body. I should say of the sick, from my observation, that the prevailing maladies are typhoid fever and camp fevers generally, diarrhea, catarrhal affections and bronchitis, rheumatism and pneumonia. These forms of sickness lead, all the rest follow. There are twice as many sick as there are wounded. The deaths range from 7 to 10% of those under treatment. April 16th, 65. I find in my notes of the time this passage on the death of Abraham Lincoln. He leaves for America's history and biography so far not only its most dramatic reminiscence, he leaves, in my opinion, the greatest, best, most characteristic, artistic, moral personality. Not but that he had faults and showed them in the presidency, but honesty, goodness, shrewdness, conscience, and a new virtue unknown to other lands and hardly yet really known here, but the foundation and tie of all, as the future will grandly develop, unionism, in its truest and amplest sense, formed the hard pan of his character. These he sealed with his life. The tragic splendor of his death, purging, illuminating all, throws round his form, his head, an aureole that will remain and will grow brighter.